This is lesson number one for a brand new set of lessons called alcohol. We're just going to call it alcohol. And our first lesson is an introduction to alcohol in the Bible. You and I don't even need to discuss it. We know that alcohol is abused to the nth degree, and it's destroying our churches. Our nation used to be a prohibition kind of nation. Even this county used to be a dry county up until the 90s. You had to go over to Jackson County if you wanted to get alcohol, and that's where all the fraternities and the sororities and the secret preachers went. Nowadays, you can just get it anytime you want it, anywhere you want it, even at the Walmart. So we have an issue, but we want to discuss what the Bible has to say. So let's jump in because this is a lengthy lesson. Alcohol is a hot button topic in the American church. Overseas, it isn't so much an issue because it's just totally abstained from. According to a new Barna report, practicing Christians drink alcohol at least occasionally at nearly the rate of the world. 60% for the church, 67% for the world. So the church is now drinking alcohol in America at the same rate as non-believers. And nearly one-third of Americans have suffered an alcohol use disorder at some point in their lives. I haven't, only because I have never been addicted to alcohol. I have had alcohol. I've had beer and wine in my life that I know of. There might be something else I didn't know of, but I've never been a social drinker. I have never been a drunkard. I've never been a partier, but I've never had an alcohol use disorder. But one in three Americans had. That means 100 million Americans. 100 million Americans have been disordered by alcohol. The shallow modern pop theology presently making the rounds is, quote, drinking alcohol is okay so long as you don't get drunk. I just heard that last week. This set of lessons will endeavor to examine alcohol from an exclusively biblical perspective, not from a cultural angle. However, cultural perspectives will be challenged in the face of the biblical text. This first lesson will simply aim to look at many of the generalized statements the Bible makes about alcohol. In essence, this will be a theological evaluation. So we're going to lay a foundation. I'm not going to really start punching against alcohol. I think I'll let the Word do it. One of the things we are doing with this lesson today, we're launching another questionnaire anonymously through the church website. And I just want to hear from you anonymously, what has alcohol done for your life? And I will write a lesson at the end called Alcohol Testimonies from a Pentecostal Church. And I want to hear what alcohol did for you. And I want the gory details, because I know, knowing you and pastoring you, there won't be anything praiseworthy that comes of it. The abundance of wine. Let's look at a historical and cultural foundation. Wine appears 213 times in the King James Version of the Old Testament. It's a lot of appearances as the word wine. Ancient Israel was long held in reputation for its wine production. That's important to understand. Even ancient Egyptian writings described the land of Israel as, quote, an excellent country. Its wine was more plentiful than water. So even back into the Bronze Age and older than that, Egyptian writings, when testifying of the land to the north of them, they knew that that land was known for its wine production and that it had more wine than water. How is that? Why is that? Israel is not a land known for its water resources. This is because of its topographical and climatical issues, its topography and its climate. In short, water availability has always been an issue in the Promised Land, and it still is to this day. Water availability has always, always, always in human history been an issue. So we have to understand, why is wine mentioned so much in the Old Testament? Why is it the drink of choice in the Old Testament? So here's a couple bullet points. Israel is a land with limited rivers and whose, quote, hills and valleys drinketh water of the rain of heaven. That's Deuteronomy 11:11. This is a reference to the karst topography and sinking streams present throughout Israel. If you go to my office right now, I have the biggest geologic map you've ever seen. It happens to be of Israel. And about two-thirds of Israel, running through the central portion of it, is all limestone carbonatic rock, karst rock. Israel is mostly limestone rock, which lends itself to karst topography, because karst only appears on limestone. What does that mean? Caves and disappearing streams. What does that mean? Rivers flow and then go underground and disappear. It is a land that literally drinketh in the rain thereof. disappearing streams. We here in Middle Tennessee, we are very much karst defined. We have sinking streams everywhere. If you go for a hike, you'll be hiking along a stream and then all of a sudden you realize it's gone. Where did it go? It went underground into the cave systems. Israel is that way to this day. Survival in ancient Israel was dependent upon water wells and cisterns to capture rain. A lot of references in the Old Testament to cisterns and wells. In 2016, the Sea of Galilee, which is in the north, which is actually a lake, 2016, so 9 years ago, it only contributed 10% of Israel's present drinking needs. So the only freshwater body they have is only capable of contributing 10% to today's population. And that's through technology of pumping and pipes. Sea of Galilee in the time of Christ or in the time of Joshua, the time of David, are you pumping water from the Sea of Galilee down to Jerusalem? No, can't do that. But even recent hydrologic reports say only 10%. And even to this day, Israel has an agreement with Jordan because the Sea of Galilee is on Jordanian territory as well. They have to send some of that water over into Jordan. In 2022, 86% of Israel's drinking water came from desalination plants. What is that? That is a massive municipal structure that takes seawater and turns it into fresh water. And it is incredibly electricity dependent, almost as bad as refining bauxite into aluminum. Incredible electricity needed to desalinate ocean water to make fresh water. So to this day, 86% of Israel's drinking water comes from desalination. As of 2025, the Jordan River, which is a freshwater river that begins at the Sea of Galilee coming out of springs and the glacial runoff of Mount Hermon to the north and the Lebanese Mountains, it runs down the Jordan Valley, ultimately dumping into the Dead Sea. As of 2025, the Jordan River is presently at only 3% of its original flow. That's because of all the agriculture in the Jordan Valley. I was there a couple months ago. It is nothing but date palm farms and plantations to this day. But we got baptized in the River Jordan at Beth Arba, or Bethany beyond Jordan. And the River Jordan, Brett and I were just there. The River Jordan is from me to that wall. That's as wide as it is. That's it. That's the River Jordan. That's your largest freshwater river in Israel. Now we were there, actually we were there in rainy season. We were there in February. That's when all the rain happens. We didn't see any rain while we were there. We were on the Jordanian side though, not the Israeli side. But Israel was right there. We were right here. But we got baptized on Jordanian mud, not Israeli mud. So I'm not sure if the baptism stuck. Our feet stuck. I'm not sure if the baptism stuck. Israel to this day also recycles over 85% of its wastewater. Everything you flush, 85% of it is recycled, put back through the system. 90% of the annual rain in Israel falls in the winter, that is November to March, or approximately 4 or 5 months, and mostly only in the north, that is up there near Galilee, which means 7 months out of the year, there is no rain at all in Israel. So why are there 213 references to wine? It's all you can drink. Okay, but how do you grow, how do you get wine? The country has never been able to rely on rain for all of their water needs. However, their yearly rainfall in those 4.5 months has always been sufficient, since Deuteronomy 11, has always been sufficient to water their 7 primary crops, including grapes. Now, it is wild to consider that rain in about 3.5-4 months of time is all that is necessary to produce grapes in abundance. Those grapes are then converted into juice, or called must, and that must can then be fermented and create wine. But to be fair, of the 213 references to wine, not all of that is the Hebrew word for alcoholic wine. Anything that comes from a grape is called wine in the Hebrew Old Testament, but it isn't all alcoholic. You have what's called new wine, which just means fresh grape juice. Deuteronomy 11:14 reads, God will send the rains in their proper seasons, the early and late rains, so you can bring in your harvests of grain, new wine, that is grapes to be crushed, and olive oil. To bring in the harvest of olive oil doesn't mean you go squeeze a tree. It means you go harvest olives, correct? Then you take it to the olive press and you put it on the olive press. Same with grapes. You go and you harvest the grapes and you bring them in bags or in barrels, and then you crush them and that makes juice. So throughout the Old Testament, anytime if you're in the King James and you read the word new wine, it has nothing to do with alcohol at all. We're just being honest and fair here, right? We're trying to answer the question, why does the American population, why does the American church drink alcohol at nearly the same rate as the world presently? Why am I against it as a preacher? Why do I think you should be against it as a believer? We're trying to answer this theologically without pounding the table and saying whatever. We want to look at what the scriptures have to say. And just as a foretaste, next week will be Jesus turned water into wine. And when we're done with that, you will probably have to resist the temptation to slap any person who says, well, Jesus turned water into wine. Yeah. Your first question should always be, yes, he did. Tell me what book, chapter, and verse that's in. Yeah. If you can just tell me where that happened in the Bible and tell me the name of the city that happened in, we could at least have a reasonable debate. But I think you don't know the Bible or God. And Jesus also raised the dead, and I don't see you trying to do that. So there's a lot of theological arguments against alcohol from the word, but we want to be fair too and talk about there is times they did drink alcohol and Jesus did drink alcohol. So how do we resolve all of that? All right. It was from grapes that wine was made, and thus Israel had more wine than water. Yeah, because the water always disappeared. It went underground or evaporated. It was trapped in their harvest. But what do you drink when you don't live near the Jordan River or a spring or an aquifer? What do you drink when the cistern is run dry? A cistern is a giant pit that you collect rainwater. If you only get 4 months of rain and you collect that, how long does that last on your family property? So viticulture were central to ancient Israelite culture. What is that? Viticulture is grapes. Viniculture is winemaking. This is seen in how many different, that is 13 different Hebrew words there are used to describe grape juice products. 13 different Hebrew words. That just tells us how central to Israeli culture grapes were. 13 different words. I've been to Iceland a couple times, and they say there's something like 47 or 57 different words for rain in Icelandic. I guess it's long winters, it rains a lot, you get bored, and you're like, well, how should we describe this rain? So you come up with a new word. Here are a few examples of how many times they are used in the King James Bible, in parentheses. So yayin, that's the most prevalent, 140 times in the Old Testament. This is your ordinary fermented wine. This is what we think of when you and I as Americans in the 21st century, when we think of wine, this is it. 140 times. Yes, they drank alcoholic wine. Why? Because when you bottle it or when you begin to press it, it has bacteria in it and yeast, and that begins to start the fermentation process almost immediately. You can even, actually every once in a while, Eddie drops the ball. I go open some grape juice. Hannah knows, she's secretary. You go open it up, grape juice welches in the church refrigerator, and you go, ooh, yeah. That's what we call jailhouse liquor right there. I'm gonna be a little Catholic and just serve that to the children in the children's department. Why do you say that's inappropriate? I will tell you a funny story. I don't know if I was 10 or 13. I took two field trips to Washington, D.C. in middle school. High school was in Seattle. And we went to the International Cathedral because it had just opened there in the mid-80s. And so it's an international cathedral, but it's more of a high church, more Catholic, more Lutheran. So you go down front for communion. So, well, I did this. We grew up Catholic, or not Catholic, going to Catholic churches some in Louisiana. So I said, yeah, let's go down front. So I go down front to take communion in the International Cathedral, the big fancy one in Washington, D.C. And I kind of froze. If you've ever been to a high church, you can drink from the chalice or just dip your wafer. I drank and I chugged. And I had no idea it was alcohol. So I think I was 10, but I got the biggest mouthful because I was actually, I think, thirsty and thought it was going to be good Baptist grape juice. It technically was. Just fast forward about 7 years, and that's what we were drinking. So by the time we got to the school bus, I was buzzing, and I didn't even know what that was. So I don't know if that's against the law, if that's contributing to the delinquency of a very minor, but my head was swimming, and I said, what is wrong with me? And the teacher said, oh, you drank communion, didn't you? Yes, that's real alcohol. And my little Baptist heart said, those heathen Catholic. The alcohol content of this wine varies from 3 to 4% up to 12%. By the time of the Roman era, most wine was diluted with water. If you do a word search in your Bible, you'll see mingled or unmingled, mixed or unmixed. And there's a reference. It was a common practice to cut all wine in biblical times with water. The term is mixed wine or unmixed wine. Even the wrath of God, the prophet and the revelation says that God will pour out his wine of wrath without mixture. Pure, uncut, you're getting both barrels and the whole nine yards of his wrath. But in this era, 3 to 12%, you couldn't get anything more than 12%. And even that was cut with water. The Romans also considered anyone who drank full-strength wine to be a barbarian. Now, that's saying something when like the most pagan culture in the world said, you're drinking more than 12%? You're a barbarian. Tarosh is often translated as new wine. That's 38 times. This is fresh must. Must is the grape juice that's extracted when you squish grapes and it still has pulp and skins in it. This is rarely, if ever, fermented. In the King James, this word usually appears in verses referencing agricultural blessing, that is the increase of corn and wine and oil, or we would say the increase of grain, the increase of grape juice, and the increase of oil. All three of these are the fruit of agriculture, that is wheat, juice, and oil, while fermented wine is technically a product. So by product of agriculture, we mean you grow wheat, you grow grapes, you grow olives. That's what you grow. Then you have to go harvest it. You with me? You cut the wheat, you pick the grapes, you pick the olives. You still have to do something after that. They all have to be processed. So what do? You thresh wheat, you crush grapes, you de-pit and crush olives. So when it talks about the blessing of God on the corn, the wine, and the oil, he's talking about the blessing on the agricultural product after it has been processed, because you still have to pick it and do something with it. You have to cut the wheat and then thresh it and sieve it and grind it, or you can eat it roasted. And then with grapes, you crush it. Of course, you can pop them whole, or olives, you can pick them and pop them whole, but you have to lie them and embitter them. Up until the second century, all olives were used for oil. You could not eat olives prior to the second century. It was the Romans that developed a technique to debitter olives. If you were to have an olive straight off the tree today, you would spit it out because it would taste as the most bitter thing you've ever had. Prior to this, all olives were ever used for was oil. And it is a trip to think it's a fruit, but it extracts an oil you can then use to burn. A fruit that produces an oil you can use on a wick and burn it. Anyway, while wheat is harvested and threshed, grapes and olives are harvested then crushed. Isaiah 65:8 reads, the new wine, that is grape juice, is found in the cluster. That kind of explains the interpretation of new wine. Grape juice is found in the cluster. There is not wine found in the grape cluster or the grape, because it's just juice. Wine, in our understanding, has to be fermented and processed and poured out and dregs removed, etc. So then you have shikar, 23 times, that is strong drink or old powerful wine. And we would add here, back in biblical times, the ability to ferment something only got you 10, 12, 14%. Modern chemistry allows us to hit 100 proof. PGA. Pure grain alcohol, which they say will make you go blind. I worked for a boss, he had moonshine. I grew up watching the Duke boys. I wondered, is this stuff really flammable? So I played with my boss's moonshine. It is really flammable. I grew up, I went to college, so I was never a frat boy, but I was familiar with them. I went rock climbing with frat boys a lot. I know what they drank. It ain't no 4%. 10%, you're just barely scratching things. Modern technology allows us to ferment beyond Bronze Age technology. And then Isiac, which means a sweet wine or new pressed juice, only 5 times. Those are the 4 most used words translated wine in some form or fashion. That means there is another 9 or so that we did not cover, because most of them are hapax legomenon, which means they're a word that only appears once in the whole text. Historical uses. Wine was used for a great many things in the ancient world, several of which are recorded in the Bible, although not all of them, and we admit that. So one of the first appearances of wine is as a libation offering. I often wonder how many Christian alcoholics will pour their drink out as an offering to the Lord. Why was it accepted as a libation offering? Well, with rainwater trapped in grapes, wine was very valuable. It took a lot of work to process. Even David, though, at one point did offer water because it was incredibly valuable. He poured it out as a libation offering as well. If you don't know what a libation offering is, it is a liquid that is simply poured over an altar or poured into the sand. It is given to God by faith. The sand drinks it in. God receives it. Does God need wine? No. Does he need water? No. Does he need your cash? No. Does he need your cow or your heifer? No. We give it to God. It's out of our life. Whatever he does with it after that, that's between him and him and him, because there's three of hims. Unless you're one is Pentecostal, and we are not. It's up to him to do with it what he wants. The libation offering, you're pouring out something valuable as a sacrifice. That's what God wants in our offerings. It was wine was used in conjunction with other offerings, often brought in the meal offering, that was the peace offering. Wine was used to treat stomach ailments, so it's used medicinally. It was used as an antiseptic because the alcohol is an astringent. It can do things. It can clean things. It was used to treat water. It was used as a pickling medium for vegetables. Red wine was used as a clothing dye. And it was, of course, the primary drink, both alcoholic and non-alcoholic. So non-alcoholic wine, which is also called new wine many times in the King James, could often be reconstituted from debash. Debash in the King James is translated as honey. Most of the time when you're seeing honey in the Old Testament, unless there's bees associated, it's not honey like we understand, because bees were not domesticated for honey production until the 3rd or 4th century AD. So everything would have been a wild honey. So anytime you see honey mentioned over and over and over again, it's a syrup. Debash just means a syrup. It's a syrup. So like Israel's a land that flows with milk and honey. Has nothing to do with bumblebees. Nothing to do with bumblebees. It has to do with the fact that Israel will be so blessed, all your fruits will be so abundant, you'll have to distill it down to a syrup to preserve it. You'll have so much surplus, you can't drink all of it in the moment. So rather than wasting it, you take all that excess juice, pomegranate juice, date juice, grape juice, and you will boil it down to make a syrup out of it, what we would call concentrate. That could be stored and it wouldn't go bad. Then what you could do, like we do with Tang and whatever else our fruit juices are, we add water to it and we reconstitute the juice from concentrate. So that's debash. King James is honey. And there might be four or five mentions of actual honeybee honey. The rest of it's going to be a fruit syrup. So land flowing with milk and honey has to do with the abundance of grass that can feed, not grass, but vegetation that can feed your goats and your cows, which gives you lots of milk, and the abundance of rain, which allows your fruit to be so productive, your fruit to be so abundant, you have to store some of it by rendering it down to a syrup that can then be stored for indefinite periods of time. Just like grandma's preserves. We did this many times growing up in college and whatnot. You open up grandma's preserves, the top part would have some mold on it. You just scrape it off and go for the rest of it. Anybody done that? Yes, Jeff, you're country. Yeah, Miss Angie, country folk get that. Same with syrup, scrape off the top. Look at all that good syrup we can go make some juice with. That was debash. So non-alcoholic wine, we just call it juice, was often reconstituted from debash. Debash was a fruit juice syrup that had been boiled down for preservation. New wine or fresh grape juice was obviously preferred over reconstituted debash. So new wine was better than reconstituted because everybody likes fresh squeezed orange juice. Even your container says not from concentrate. Why? That's lower grade even at the Walmart. First appearance of alcohol. The rest of this lesson, we're just going to look at the first seven appearances of alcohol in the Bible and see what the Bible has to say about it. I believe in the hermeneutical principle, law first mention, which tells us anytime something happens for the first time, it's recorded on purpose for a reason, we should pay attention to it. The first mention of alcohol and drunkenness in the Bible is in Genesis chapter 9. And it has to do with Noah and his post-deluge vineyard. So we'll begin reading in verse 20. After the flood, Noah began to cultivate the ground and he planted a vineyard. One day he drank some wine he had made, and he became drunk and lay naked inside his tent. And I wonder, were you drinking while you were naked? Did you drink and get drunk and get hot and take all your clothes off? How do you pass out naked in your tent? I get it. It's your tent. It's your abode. Your boys are off somewhere else. Your family's off somewhere else. Where's your wife? Where's Noah's wife in all this? These are questions I think. The more I read it, I start wondering, what's the scenario here? The Bible gives us the high points, and then we're just left to wonder. He's drunk. He's passed out drunk naked. Ham, the father of Canaan, saw that his father was naked and went outside and told his brothers. Then Shem and Japheth took a robe, held it over their shoulders, and backed in the tent to cover their father. As they did this, they looked the other way so they would not see him naked. So, from planting a vineyard to being able to drink wine would probably take no less than 4 to 5 years, because from the time you plant a vineyard to the time it can be productive and fruitful is no less than 4 years. Levitical law goes on to say the first is no fruit, the fourth year is offered to the Lord, and the fifth year you can eat thereof. But if you want really good grapes, you're talking 6 and 7 years, and then to actually make wine is at least a year. Especially if you're gonna hit 10 and 12% alcohol, you're gonna have to let it ferment and sit, and then if you wanna age it. So I estimate no less than 5 years. We often think he comes off the boat, throws a seed down, drinks a swig, and falls down naked, and Ham walks in and says, look, Dad's naked. We're talking years later, years later. Instead of trying to read through the Bible in a year, slow down and ask good questions that will build theology and faith. I'm not against reading through the Bible in a year, but it's not gonna do you as good as if you just slowed down and enjoyed the Bible. Why this? How long did it take? If the world was flooded, is there already a vineyard? Maybe Google, how long does it take to grow a vineyard? How long does it take to make wine? What does an old tent look like? Ask these questions out loud, or you can just keep checking on your bookmark and get through the Bible in a year. Now, if all you have time to do is just breeze through the Bible, do it. It's better than nothing. But you'll do better studying the Bible, not just reading it. There's a big difference between reading the Bible in a year and actually studying the Bible. I would also say, because I am a Bible teacher, if you study the Bible, it would be easy to spend an entire year in one chapter. You might hit 1,000 other chapters, but you would stay 1 year in one chapter. That would do you a lot better than just saying, I read through the whole Bible. Well, what did it say to you? But if God had you in Malachi for a year, you'd know everything about Malachi backwards and forwards until he took you through Malachi again. We have to keep moving here. This is the first use of yayin. That's the Hebrew word for alcoholic wine. Sadly, this is our first introduction to alcohol and drunkenness and what it does. Noah's debauchery, because Noah failed, there's no way around that, tempted his son Ham to sin. The first appearance of wine and alcohol and drunkenness is about tempting your brother or your son to sin. We have a New Testament reciprocal for that. If you do anything that causes a baby to stumble, it's interesting, our first appearance of wine and drunkenness also results in someone else sinning. Not just Noah, his son sinned, and then his son gets cursed. Isn't that always the case? You might could handle a little bit of sin, but you tempt your brother to sin and he becomes an addict. To me, I don't have the interpretation, but I don't know why it's fair that Noah's the one that falls down and gets drunk naked, or naked drunk, and Ham's the one that gets in trouble. Now, Ham sinned for sure, but why is Ham the one cursed, and why isn't Noah in trouble? Which this in turn resulted in Ham and his lineage being cursed, which is not a good introduction to wine. But again, we've already covered, we have to have it because we don't have enough drinking water for anything else. Second appearance of alcohol, yayin. The next appearance of wine or alcohol in the Bible is quite curious. It involves brazen Christ typology. Genesis 14, 17 through 20. After Abram returned from his victory over Chedorlaomer and all his allies, the king of Sodom went out to meet him in the valley of Shaveh, that is the king's valley. And Melchizedek, the king of Salem and a priest of God Most High, brought Abram some bread and wine. Melchizedek blessed Abraham with this blessing, saying, blessed be Abraham by God Most High, creator of heaven and earth. Blessed be God Most High who has defeated your enemies for you. Then Abram gave Melchizedek a tenth of all the goods he had recovered. What you see here is a worship service. And everybody agrees. And by everybody, I mean every Christian theologian. And how rare is that? That every Christian theologian can look at something in the Old Testament and agree. This is Christ's typology. He is Melchizedek. Now, why can we all agree on that? Because it's here, it appears in Psalms, it appears in Hebrews, that Christ is forever a priest after the order of Melchizedek. This is the first mention of a priestly order known as Melchizedek. Melchizedek was a king priest over the village that would grow into to be Jerusalem. He was the king of Salem, that is Jerusalem. He initiated fellowship with Abram by bringing the patriarch bread and wine after his battle against Chedorlaomer. Isn't that like Jesus Christ to initiate fellowship with us by bringing us the bread and the wine, that is the body broken and the blood shed? This is universally understood to be a foreshadow of Christ in the communion table. The presentation of these fellowship elements is followed by Melchizedek blessing Abram, then Abram tithing to the priest king. This is a worship service and a type of the Last Supper and communion. Pretty cool that in Genesis you see a type and shadow of communion. Bread and wine, bread and wine, bread and wine. This does not give us authorization to be drunkards or to even be social drinkers. This is a worship service. This is a worship service. How do we know? They fellowship, there's a blessing, then there's a tithe. It's all acts of worship. Third appearance of alcohol, Yayin. The third mention of wine in the Bible involves incestuous rape. Hooray! Wow. We're two for three here. Hooray! Genesis 19, 31 through 33, New Living Translation. One day the older daughter said to her sister, this is Lot's daughters, there are no men left anywhere in this entire area, which is not true because they were not far from a city. We're already seeing excuses. So we can't get married like everyone else. There was just another city that they just said, we don't want to go to. We're scared. Let's go live in a cave. Well, this is delusional. And our father will soon be too old to have children. Come, let's get him drunk with wine, and then we will have sex with him. Think about that. Pause, Selah. We're too lazy to go into the next town to find a man or to be found. So you know what we need to do? Dad's almost too old to have children, impotence or sterility. Let's get him drunk and rape him. Me one night, you the next. It's a bizarre story, isn't it? Shows you how debauched Sodom was, that this is the product of keeping your kids there. This is how they think. This is common sense to them. They're in agreement. They're like, we have ideas. Ooh, that's a good idea. Let's do it. And the other sister doesn't say, what are you thinking? She's like, that makes sense. I guess we cast lots to see who goes first. So that night, that way we will preserve our family line through our father. They just might have 12 toes. So that night, they got him drunk with wine, and the older daughter went in and had intercourse with her father. He was unaware of her lying down or getting up again. That's super drunk when you don't even remember having sex with your daughter. I have all sorts of questions that are not Sunday school appropriate. We cut the story short because then the next night, the other sister goes in and does the same thing. They create the enemies of Israel through their offspring. So my interpretation of this is, I guess the family that drinks together commits paternal incestuous rape together. What else is your takeaway from that story? Now, isn't it interesting? Alcohol can be used as a worship service with Melchizedek, a forerunner of Christ, or we can be drunks and rape family members. Intentionally, with purpose. And that's all the interpretation I have to offer for that story. It's the third appearance of wine and the second appearance of drunkenness in the Bible. Both appearances of drunkenness don't result in anything good. Both involve nakedness. The fourth appearance of alcohol, which involves both Yayin and Tarosh, the fourth mention of alcoholic wine in the Bible is a neutral reference concerning a meal served by Jacob to his father Isaac. We know the story. He wants Isaac's blessing. Isaac's going blind. So Rebekah helps dress up Jacob as his brother Esau with woolly arms, and his brother's smell prepares a meal. Isaac then mistakenly blesses Jacob, which included a blessing upon new wine. That would be the grape harvest or grape juice. Genesis 27 reads, and he, that is the disguised Jacob, brought him, that is Isaac, wine, that is alcoholic wine, anywhere between 3% and 12%. And if we understand historicity accurately, it would have been cut with water to make it go further, but also to treat whatever water was available. Honestly, if you can only get grapes once a year, are you going to guzzle all of it? Or are you going to cut it? It only makes sense concerning supply and rationing that you would cut it. Treat the water that you do have available. I was up on what is believed to be Mount Sinai back in February in Saudi Arabia, and there was still a puddle of water up there from the rain or snow melt runoff. And I could see how you look at that puddle of water and you think, we need that, but I don't know if it's safe to drink. But we got some wine that's got alcohol. That stuff kills anything. Let's cut it. You can totally see how there might be puddles and cisterns, some goo down in the bottom of it. You put it in a bag so it can strain it, and then you still cut it with alcohol or wine to give it some flavor, but also to treat the water. Regardless, it doesn't say that Jacob got drunk here. He just drank, or Isaac got drunk here. So the blessing is this: therefore God give thee of the dew of heaven and the fatness of the earth and plenty of corn and wine, that is tarosh or crushed grapes. So hear the blessing of God pronounced by Jacob over Isaac Isaac over Jacob thinking that Jacob was Esau. The blessing was pronounced upon two of the three primary crops. Remember, the primary crops are grain, grapes, and olives. So here we have blessing over grain and grapes. God bless thee. He blessed two of the three crops, grain and grapes. As observed earlier, corn and wine and corn, wine and oil are phrases repeated regularly in the Old Testament that indicate provision and prosperity. So we just point this out because it's our fifth reference here, right? Our fourth reference to alcohol or to wine. These were the three primary crops, grain, grapes, and olives. Trying to be fair, trying to give alcohol a fair shake. I have had debates where they're like, Chris, you know the Bible, so how can you be against alcohol? I'll make no bare bones about it. I'm against alcohol. Mostly because it destroys people's lives. And here in America, we're all for moderation, except we don't live it. You tell me one thing the average American is moderate with. Can the average American even spell moderation? Can they live it? No. We can't do anything in moderation. And yes, I know Jesus said nothing goes in your mouth will defile you. But that doesn't mean you should eat lithium batteries. Of course, the context was ritual defilement. I don't think you should purposely go find roadkill and get a spoon out and big old pile of hot maggots. I don't think you should do that either. And I get it. Drinking alcohol will not defile you, but Jesus said everything that comes out of your mouth will. So we have to resolve this in other ways, and we will in the coming lessons. Fifth major appearance of alcohol, yayin. We're going to skip ahead in the Old Testament past the many sacrifice prescriptions of the law and the ordinances of the Nazirite vow to an interesting passage. Deuteronomy 29:5-6 reads, for 40 years I, Moses, led you through the wilderness, yet your clothes and sandals did not wear out. You ate no bread, they had manna, and you drank no wine or other alcoholic drink. But God gave you food so you would know that he is the Lord your God. Where'd they get water from in the wilderness? Think about it. There's a story. The rock. He struck the rock. Didn't have to be purified, didn't have to be sanctified, didn't have to be filtered, didn't have to be cut. Supernaturally, God twice had water come out of a rock to take care of his people. They didn't have to make an excuse. But what I found interesting here, because I honestly just saw this verse for the first time in the last week or two, they fasted alcohol for 40 years. That's not a bad idea. I think if I were to fast alcohol for the next 40 years, that'd get me into heaven. Not through works or through salvation, but like that, I'm almost 49. That would take me to almost 90. I'm not sure I want to live that long. The longer I'm here on this planet, the more heaven's looking appealing to me. 40 years would take me right to heaven's door and I'd be good. I like what Dr. Barclay said. They said, well, how'd you quit alcohol? He said, well, I started fasting and I just never stopped. Start fasting alcohol since Vietnam War. Sixth major appearance of alcohol. And our last one for this lesson. The final major story involving wine concerns barren Hannah and her desperate prayers for a son. 1 Samuel chapter 1. And Hannah was praying to the Lord. Eli the high priest watched her. Seeing her lips moving, but hearing no sound, this tells us why prayer should be audible. This is the only appearance anywhere in 66 books and 32,000 verses where you find somebody praying inaudibly. That's important. It teaches us that prayer, other than the Hebrew word and the Greek word and the Aramaic word, it teaches us that prayer is an oration and it is to be declared unto God. Prayer in your mind is not prayer, it's thoughts or meditation. Prayer in your heart is not prayer, it's thoughts and meditation. She's praying, the high priest, the anointed one, he sees her lips moving but no sound, and he thought she'd been drinking. So the high priest under the Mosaic law assumed if you're praying and no sound's coming out, you're drunk. Now, we Pentecostals, we're made fun of for lots of things, but everybody here knows when your denominational person, family member needs prayer, they come to you. Because they know we know how to pray. We're not good at everything, but prayer is something we are good at. They'll make fun of me and my family for every other belief, but when they want God to move, they know who to come ask. Then why don't you let me disciple you on how to pray yourself? Well, we want to take a moment of silence. Why? We're going to have a jet fly over? So stupid. He said, must you come here drunk? He demanded. Throw away your wine. Oh, no, sir, she replied. I haven't been drinking wine or anything stronger, but I'm very discouraged. So she was drunk with pain. And I was pouring out my heart to the Lord. She was vomiting, just not alcohol, pouring out her complaint before the Lord. Don't think I am a wicked woman. King James says, don't think your daughter to be a child of Belial. That's a demonized woman. For I have been praying out of great anguish and sorrow. In that case, Eli said, go in peace, shalom. May the God of Israel grant the request you have asked of him. Do you think he would have given that to her if she'd been drunk? Drunkenness was not acceptable in the Old Testament, especially in the tabernacle. Eli believed Hannah's silent prayer to be indicative of inebriation. Her silent prayer to the priest said she's drunk. That tells you something about silent prayer, how ineffective it is. If I were to pray in the name of Jesus and we were to try to cast out a devil right now, could I do it like this? Even if I had like magic hands and was like, for those listening on recording, my hands are like, I don't know, doing some mumbo jumbo. How do you cast out a devil? Come out! You command. That's how we pray. We declare things and they are established. The priest offered some great wisdom to the presumed alcoholic. Throw away your wine. Wow, that's such good wisdom from 1 Samuel. Get rid of it. Even though it was also a commanded offering. Do you see how he goes from her ditch, assumed ditch, to the other ditch to help her? God would rather you get rid of it than bring it, drink it, get drunk, and offer some of it. Get rid of all of it. Get rid of all of it. Her sobriety allowed the priest to bless her with shalom. I don't believe drunks can be blessed by God. The fact that you're drunk shows you're not blessed. God's not cursing you, but he's just not blessing you. He might be preserving you. That's mercy. That's not a blessing. I mean, in fact, that you're not dead, that is a blessing. But mercy, like you're going to spend the rest of your life smelling like a liquor cabinet. That's not a blessing. Her sobriety allowed the priest to bless her with peace. Alcoholics have no peace. And invoke the fulfillment of her prayer request. God, give you what you seek him for. I wonder if alcohol has ever served to hinder other people's prayers. Obviously, yes. 10, 11 years ago, we had the vacation Bible school, and we had that giant pirate ship we built for the stewardship. We did a play. We had massive production value, but I needed a barrel for the play. So we went down to Jack Daniels, me and Dr. Cephas and Will Hutchinson. And Lynchburg, Tennessee, I told Dr. Cephas, this is gonna be fun. You're a black guy, this is called Lynchburg for a reason. You'll be the only black guy we're here. And of course, Cephas just eats it up everywhere he goes. So we went to Jack Daniels. We took a tour because I enjoy the chemistry and it's fascinating. It's the only place Jack Daniels is made in the whole world, and all the water comes out of a cave, and that's my thing, karst geology. But we went down there to buy a barrel. So you go in there and you're like, hey, we're from a church. We want to buy a whiskey barrel. And they think like the full one, which is like 20 grand. No. I want an empty one. So I said, this is beat all you ever see. Two white guys, a black guy, we're rolling down in a vacation Bible school whiskey barrel for Jesus' sake, right? So we go into then it was the new tourist room, and you walk in there and it just reeks of whiskey. It just reeks of rye. I don't know all of it. So we go in there and I said, woof, this smells like whiskey. And Willie B said, this smells like my dad. His dad had died of cirrhosis. Dad was an alcoholic his whole life. I don't want anybody's child to remember them smelling like JD. What a horrible upbringing. And Will told me, he said, near the end of my dad's life, all of his organs were failing, I guess, my dad would take medicine and he would forget to flush the toilet and all the medicine would still be in his stool. None of it processed. I don't know what JD, I don't know what whiskey, I don't know what proof whiskey is because I'm not an alcohol guy, but you drink that stuff long enough, it eats through your guts. It eats through your gizzard. As we might expect, the Bible has much more to say about alcohol, and this time I actually started including footnotes from some of my research, but anyway. Father, thank you for this first lesson on alcohol. Help us be sober-minded. Help us look to glorify you, not our own carnal appetites or our addiction. Help us to see everything the Bible says about alcohol. You have an answer for everything, Lord. Above all, may we find your heart and glorify your name. In Jesus' name we pray, amen.